formalism for operational quantum mechanics. I should mention this formalism can also be used independently of your interpretive persuasions. But the history of a lot of what I'm telling you, in particular positive operator valued measures and generalized transformations, comes from various places, one of which was Ludwig's school. And Ludwig was looking to axiomatize quantum mechanics. So there is a tradition that if, and it's certainly true that if you want to be an operationalist, then this is the formalism that you ought to use. So review of where we've gotten to. So originally, we started with the notion that vectors were associated with preparations, Hermitian operators were associated with measurements. And then last time, we showed that the more general notion of preparation is density operator. I didn't mention it explicitly, but one can, for any density operator you can write down, any operator that satisfies the properties of positivity and having unit trace, you can find some preparation procedure that implements it, either via a mixture of pure states or by entangling with another system and tracing out that system. And the way you calculate probabilities is just by the generalization of the Born rule, trace of the density operator times the projectors that appear in the spectral resolution of your Hermitian operator. Now, one small thing that I want to do is change the way we describe measurements in this framework. And instead of talking about our Hermitian operator with eigenvalues ak, just talk about the set of projectors and spectral resolution. So that's called a projection-valued measure. The terminology comes from the case where you have a continuous index, which we're not going to consider. But we're going to keep the terminology nonetheless. So it's a bit heavy-handed. It might be better to say something like a projector resolution of unity or something. But we'll call it a projection-valued measure. And of course, the reason we can drop the eigenvalues here is because the probabilities of outcomes k don't depend on those eigenvalues at all. So they're just labels for the outcomes. And the probability distribution over the outcomes can be assessed independently of them. OK, so that's where we were up to. And today, I'm going to argue that you have to generalize your representation of the measurements to positive operator. That shouldn't be position. I'm sorry. That should be positive. Positive operator valued measures, which are just sets of positive operators, which I'll denote by EK. They might be larger in number than the most projectors you could have in a resolution of unity. So there could be arbitrarily many of them. And you'll see that the Born rule generalizes to have exactly the same form, except it's trace row EK now, rather than the projectors. So the differences between projector-valued measures and positive operator-valued measures is indicated here. So their projectors are positive operators, as are the E's that we're going to consider. The projectors will sum to identity. So too must the E's, because that says that the total probability is going to be 1. The Born rule looks the same in both cases. The difference is that for the projectors, they were orthogonal. If I multiply two projectors with different indices, I got 0. And an individual projector squared gave me the projector back again. That condition no longer holds. So these POVM elements, which are sometimes called effects, don't have to be orthogonal. And they don't have to be projectors. Their square can be not equal to themselves. OK. So why do we get that? Well, we're going to do something similar to what we did last time. I'm going to give you some examples to motivate this new formalism. Yes? So
they have eigenvalues 1 or 0?
They are just positive operators, so their eigenvalues are all positive. Because they sum to identity, you know that each one of them also has to be smaller than identity. So if I take identity minus one of these positive operators, I get another positive operator.
So it's just an arbitrary partition of unity.
Exactly. You could call it a partition of unity, a positive partition of unity. But for some reason, the terminology has stuck as positive operator valued measure, because if the index is continuous, then it's a measure. OK. So let's consider a first simple example. So suppose you have these three measurement procedures here, which are each associated with projection-valued measures. So I could write down a Hermitian operator for each. And now what I do is I build a new measurement procedure out of them, where I roll some dice, which are described by this probability distribution, P of I. And upon getting outcome I, I send my system to the ith measurement device. So I can certainly do that. I can build this and put it all in a black box. And then what I want to output as the outcome of this new measurement is both the index I that was generated here and the outcome k that was generated by whichever of these measurements was done. So here I'm presuming all three of these measurements have the same number of outcomes. I'm just going to report which one was implemented and what the outcome was. That's I and j. And I'm going to just call that by the single index k. So that's the output of the big box. And the question is, how do I represent that in the form loop? So we got the familiar situation where I want to know, sorry, this is falling off the screen, we want to know the probability of I and j. So that's just the probability that the dice gives me outcome I times the probability of getting outcome j, given that the dice was I. And I noticed that there is a typo here. These should all be j. These outcomes are labeled j. K is the pair of I and j. OK, so that's just the probability of getting I and j. But now I know what the probability of getting outcome j, given that I measured I, is. That's just given by my Born rule. The trace of the whatever density operator I feed in times the projector, the jth projector in the ith set. And then I can just move this probability inside the trace if I want to. And this now has the form of the Born rule again, except instead of having a projector here, it has a subnormalized projector, which is just a positive operator. Right? Its square is not equal to itself. And it's labeled by I and j. OK, so if I just replace the I and j with the single k label, that's the Born rule I advertised. Now, let's verify the properties of this ek operator. It's positive, because if I sandwich this guy here between two states psi, well, the expectation value of the projector is positive, and these pi's are positive, so the whole thing is positive. And that's true for all the states. And I have to verify that they sum to identity. So again, if I look here, and I sum over k, well, that corresponds to summing over both I and j. This k is just a shorthand. So it's a sum over I and j of pi, I sub j. So if I do the sum over j first, well, because the projectors form a resolution of identity themselves, I just get identity when I sum over j. And the p's are probability distribution, so they sum to 1. So that's just identity. So you confirm that property. This, therefore, is a positive operator valued measure. And it's what describes this effective measurement. So it's very much like the generalization from pure quantum states to mixed quantum states. OK, let's look at an example to make it more concrete. So suppose my dice is actually a coin. That's fair. So it's 50-50 for coming up heads or tails. And if it comes up heads, I measure the 0-1 basis. And if it comes up tails, I measure the plus-minus basis. Well, if you just use that formula, pi times the projectors, you'll see that this is the POVM that's associated with the measurement. So the first element is just a half times the first outcome. So this is the probability that I'll get heads and the first outcome of the measurement. So clearly that's right, because I have a probability of half of getting heads, and then trace of rho, projector onto 0, of getting the first outcome when I measure that first measurement. This is the positive operator associated with getting heads and the second outcome. This is getting tails and the first outcome. Of course, if I got tails, then I'm measuring this over here, so it's a plus. And that's tails and getting the second outcome. So very simple. Now, to verify that these guys sum up to identity, I mean, it's trivial to see it, but let me point out a different way of seeing it, which is recall from our discussion yesterday of the Bloch sphere that the states 0, 1, plus and minus are represented by these poles of the one disk on the Bloch sphere. And if I were to weight them with equal probability in a mixture, well, then by symmetry, they would have to sum up to the completely mixed state, the one at the center. So I would have to have this equation, right, that a quarter weighting of all of them gives me a half times the identity. Multiply that whole thing through by 2, and you get a bunch of things on the left that sum up to identity. That's a resolution of unity. So these guys are a resolution of unity. But a less trivial fact is that any time you have a decomposition of the completely mixed state into some pure states or some other states, right? And we saw how many of them there were yesterday. You just draw any old polytope that contains the completely mixed state, and the vertices of that polytope are the states in some decomposition. So anytime you have such a decomposition, you just have to multiply it through by 2, and those vertices, now multiplied by 2, give you a set of effects which together form a POVM. So you have this huge multiplicity of different POVMs, which is isomorphic to the multiplicity of different decompositions of the completely mixed state. So I'm going to use these pictures to describe POVMs with the understanding that these pictures don't capture the normalization. But nonetheless, they'll be a useful guide for thinking about POVMs in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. OK, so let's consider another way that you could build one measurement out of another, which is just coarse graining. So here I imagine I have some measurement. Maybe it's a POVM. And it's associated with operators f sub j. And then all I'm going to do is, you know, there may be many different values that j could take. I'm going to start binning them. So if it gives me any of these three outcomes, then the final outcome I'm going to report is just 1. And if it gives me these outcomes, I'll report 2, and so on. So I'm just binning up outcomes. And I want to know, what's the POVM that corresponds to this effect? What's the probability of getting that first outcome, meaning any of these three? Well, that's very easy. The probability of k is just the sum of all the j indices that are in the set associated with k. Right? This is just defined by my binning operation. And so then if I ask, well, what's the POVM element that reproduces this probability rule? Well, on the left, I say I want a POVM element ek such that when I trace it with rho, I get p of k. And on the right, this is the probability of getting the outcome j. So I want an ek that satisfies this equation. Well, I can just move the sum inside and note that this new equation now has to be true for all rho. Okay, and then the only subtle bit in the proof is that, as I said yesterday, the Hermitian operators form a real vector space of dimension d squared, and this trace AB is an inner product. So this is basically saying that EK, its projection onto rho in this real vector space is the same as the projection of this operator onto rho in the real vector space. And this is true for all rho. So if I take the projection of these two operators onto all possible rhos, I get exactly the same thing. And it turns out, I won't prove it to you, but it turns out that the set of all density operators form a basis for that real vector space. And so if the projections are the same for all the elements in a basis, then the objects are the same. So you just find that this EK is just the sum of the FJs. So it's what you might expect, right, given this fact. To know, if I want to consider a result that's all three of these outcomes, well, I just sum those three effects together, and I plug that into my Born rule to get the overall probability. OK, so I'm going to use this in some examples that are coming up. Here's the first one. So it's the one we had before, right, where we measure either the 0, 1 basis or the plus minus basis. And we decide it by a coin flip. That's fair. We already talked about how this was the appropriate POVM. And now I'm going to coarse grain it. So what happens if I coarse grain these two elements and coarse grain these two elements? All right, well, you just sum these guys up. So I sum this up, and I sum these two up. And that's 0 plus 1 is just identity. So that's a half identity, a half identity. Now, what's the meaning of that POVM?
We basically looked and said there's a particle there?
Basically, yeah. But I could have also just had the identity POVM that has just one element that's identity. And that would be also well described by I've just looked and there's a particle there. This POVM has two outcomes.
Corresponding to which basis we measured it on?
Yes. So what you're coarse graining over is the outcome of each of these measurements. And so you're basically doing something very silly. You're flipping a coin, you're measuring this, you're measuring that, and then you're forgetting the outcome. The only thing that gets output is how the coin came up. So what this POVM describes is just a coin flip, right? And if you think about it, if you take trace of any density operator with a half identity, you get a half. And so this says, regardless of the state you feed in, the probability of outcome 1 is a half. And the probability of outcome 2 is a half. So this is just a sophisticated way of describing a coin flip. It says, ignore the state of the system entirely, flip this coin, and report the outcome you got. That's it. Is that clear? All right. So that's just a coin flip. And you could have any sort of, if you want an arbitrary distribution of PIs, you just stick identities in front of them, and you'll get a POVM which simulates that probability distribution. OK, here's the second example. We're going to get to things that are a bit more interesting in a moment. So suppose now I use this new POVM we've just discovered, half identity, which, as you'll recall, corresponds to just ignoring the state of the particle entirely, let it run into a brick, and flip a coin. And that's your outcome. But now I want to say you flip a coin ahead of time, which is weighted. So it has probability Q coming up heads, 1 minus Q coming up tails. And based on its outcome, you either measure the 0, 1 basis, or you just ignore the state and you flip a fair coin. OK, so if you reported both the outcome here and the outcome of these measurements, well, it would just be Q times 0 for the heads first outcome, Q times 1 heads second outcome. And then we get 1 minus Q times the two possibilities for these two outcomes. So this is the four-element POVM that corresponds to that. And now suppose that I coarse grain over how the coin came up. So this time I want to forget how the coin, like this first coin here, landed. I only want to report the outcome of whatever measurement was done. So I coarse grain this guy and this guy. They're the ones that both correspond to heads. And I get Q projector onto 0 plus 1 minus Q times a half identity. And I coarse grain this guy and this guy, and I get that expression. So you can rewrite that if you want as 1 plus Q over 2, 0, plus 1 minus Q over 2, 1. And the point is that for Q, a probability, this, well, you can just by inspection see that these two guys sum to identity. But it's this term here is more heavily weighted on the 0 and less heavily weighted on the 1. So if I made Q 1, this term would disappear and I just have a 0, 1 measurement, which would say it's all going through here. But as I decrease Q, I get more and more randomness injected into this measurement. So this is effectively a noisy measurement of the 0, 1 basis. You could think of it as a model of a measurement device which sometimes fails. Sometimes it does the measurement you're asking it to do, and sometimes it just generates noise. It generates a completely random outcome. And the probability it does that is 1 minus Q. So if you think about representing this in the block sphere picture, well, those two terms, here and here, correspond to density operators that lie halfway between the center and the top and halfway between the center and the bottom. And so this is what a noisy measurement of spin along the z-axis looks like in this block sphere picture. These are not as far as they could be. And what it means is that if I come up to this device and I feed in a zero state, I don't necessarily get the up outcome. I only get that outcome with probability Q, or sorry, 1 plus Q over 2. And with probability 1 minus Q over 2, I get the opposite outcome. So this is an error-prone measurement of S sub z. Good. So let's go back to the measurement we had originally, the equal mixture of 0, 1, and plus minus. These were the four points on the block sphere that corresponded to it. And now let's do a new coarse graining. Last time we considered coarse graining the first two and the second two, and we got just a coin flip. But let's coarse grain it differently this time. We'll coarse grain the first and the third, and the second and the fourth. And I won't write out explicitly what those positive operators are, because you can see from this picture what they'll be. The first and the third, so this is 0, this is 1, this is plus, this is minus. So 0 and plus combined with equal weights would give me the density operator halfway in between. Here I'm summing them, and so effectively that's like giving these two effects equal weights. And so I'm going to get an effect that's proportional to this density operator. Here, if I sum these guys, that's the 1 and the minus state, I'll get an effect that's proportional to that density operator. And so what you see is that it's just a noisy measurement of the spin along this axis, this diagonal axis. So let me call that axis the n axis. This is just a noisy s dot n measurement. Of course, I could coarse grain in another way. I could take the first and the fourth and the second and the third outcomes. And that just corresponds to taking 0 with minus and 1 with plus. And I'm now going to get a noisy measurement of the spin along the n perpendicular direction. I'll just call this n perp. So this is really nice. It says that by doing this one measurement with the four outcomes, and then coarse grading in one of two different ways, I can either get a measurement along the n spin axis or along the n perpendicular spin axis. Of course, these are noisy measurements, but the point is that I do get information, and you can think of this as a joint measurement of Sn and Sn perp. Let me come to you in a second, but there's nothing here that specifies what n and n, what the direction n has to be. I can rotate all of this. And so n and n perp could be z and x. And so this gives me a way of jointly measuring the spin along the z-axis and the spin along the x-axis. These things don't commute. We know we can't come to learn them perfectly simultaneously, but what we can do with one of these POVMs is have a noisy measurement of spin along z simultaneously with a noisy measurement of spin along x. And this is actually the minimum noise you have to add. It turns out it's 1 over q has to be 1 over root 2. If you add that much noise, then you can achieve a simultaneous measurement of the two. It's still pretty good because 1 over root 2 is quite high. You can still, if I feed in a measurement, one of the states that's an eigenstate here, I can still have a pretty high probability of estimating it correctly. Similarly here, if I feed in an eigenstate, I can have a high probability of estimating it correctly. Question?
This coarse grain, it's studied classically then?
That's right.
So we could take, so we still get then the precise measurements at each of these four points as well as?
That's right. You don't have to do this coarse grain. You could hold on to all the information. And then when somebody comes up to you and says, think of it this way, right? If somebody said, at some point, I'm not going to tell you what I'm feeding into your device. It might be a z eigenstate, it might be an x eigenstate. I'm not going to tell you right now. But after you finish your measurement, I'm going to get you to try to predict which outcome it was. I'm only going to tell you whether I prepared a z or an x eigenstate after you finish your measurement. So you do this measurement, you keep all the data around, then I tell you which one, and you make your guess accordingly by coarse grading. So that's the sort of use you can put a joint measurement to.
So in order to do that, then, we have to have two copies of the state to plot, or because we're looking at now, or we still can't take, though, all four of those points, though, right?
So these four points represent four outcomes of a measurement. So there is something you do in the lab which has four outcomes that are associated with those four points. And so when I feed you an arbitrary state, the probabilities of the outcomes will be given by a trace of rho times each of these effects. And then you get some data, you know, one out of four numbers. And you can process that data. You know, basically, all that's relevant for the question of whether it's up or down along this axis is whether you got one of these two outcomes or one of those two outcomes. So you just sum up the probabilities of getting, or you just look and say, did I get one of those two or one of these two? And when you ask, what's the probability that I'll have estimated correctly, it's just Q, this noise factor in your POVM. Right. 1 plus Q over 2 is what it is. Other questions? Yeah?
Sorry. So, like, E naught there is this, like, the operator is the sum of the zero zero operator and plus plus. Okay,
yes.
And physically, a way you could realize it is by taking your thing, randomly choosing up down or left right magnets,
yep.
And then letting one of the outcomes run into a brick from each measurement. From each.
Well, no, there's no brick here. So the way you implement that guy.
Sorry, I mean like.
Yes.
You choose either up, down, or left, right magnets.
Yes. Yes.
And then you have the detector go off if it goes off or if it goes right.
Yeah, because it's like, okay. So here you're measuring 0, 1, here you're measuring plus, minus. And you just say, if I either got the measured 0, 1, and got 1, or I measured plus, minus, and got minus, then I expect that the spin is down along this n-axis. Right? So I will report the outcome down along that.
So the thing in brackets up there is a POVM, and
yes.
The thing in brackets down there is also a POVM.
That's right.
So mathematically, how do you combine them into the joint measurement you were talking about?
Ah, well, that's a good question. So take the inverse problem. Suppose I gave you these two POVMs. You know, so ignore the gray, and I just gave you these two POVMs, and I said, is there a way of measuring those simultaneously? Well, you might go off and think about it, and then you might realize, if you measured this four-element POVM and coarse-grained in one of two ways, you would achieve a simultaneous measurement of them. But now, what if I ask you, what's the most general conditions that a set of POVMs have to satisfy in order for them to be measured simultaneously?
So I don't see how that did what you want. Like, so you say you measure the four-element
yes.
thing.
Yes.
And that's... So how did you... Maybe I should back up and ask how you could physically realize that four element POVM.
Well, we just did it earlier, right? So if I, with probability half, I measure this basis, with probability half, okay. I measure this basis, and I keep track of which one I measure, then that's four outcomes. Two outcomes for the measurement, and two possibilities for how my coin came up.
Okay.
There are other ways of measuring it, and on the next couple of slides, I'll get to a different way of measuring it. But if you define joint measurability as the ability to simulate the statistics, so if I have two POVMs and I want to jointly measure them, it means I can do one POVM, process the data in one of two ways, and have the same statistics as the first or the same statistics as the second. Let's call that simulating those two POVMs simultaneously. So the interesting fact is that we still don't know the answer to the question of what are the general conditions under which a set of POVMs can be jointly measured. For projective value measures, it's very simple. They have to commute. We all learn that in basic quantum mechanics. For POVMs, we don't yet have the answer. So it's a good open research problem.
So this seems to like sort of an odd language. If I knew the result of the coin flip, if I flipped mm-hmm. a coin and I said it came up heads, so I'm measuring up, down, then I would interpret the result once I'm done as, like, I've gained information
yes.
about the spin of the particle in the vertical.
Yes.
If I don't know the measure, if I don't know the outcome of the coin flip, then it seems like this is saying I should interpret the outcome as I've gained information about both the vertical spin and the horizontal spin of the particle, because I don't know which one I measured. Like, sort of.
Like what it's saying is that if you measure the 0-1 basis, then you get some information about the spin along this axis. And what it says is that if you got the zero outcome, then with high probability, the spin was down. Let's say the axis is pointing this way, down along this axis. And if I got the one outcome, with high probability, it's up. Similarly, if I measure this basis, it gives me some information about up versus down along this axis. And so the point is that I flip a coin, I measure this or this, and I guess appropriately. And then I ask the question, how often is my guess correct? And the answer is, you know, 1 plus q over 2, where q can be as high as 1 over root 2. So that's better than you might have expected. In any case, I should probably move on. The point is that, you know, yesterday I talked about how you could take a probe and, you know, connect one probe to the position of a particle and one probe to the momentum of the particle. And intuitively, you might think you get information about both position and momentum this way. And that's exactly the sort of thing that's happening here. You're getting information about both the position in x and the position in z. And it's very strange that we don't learn about POVMs in textbook quantum mechanics, because in fact, every measurement that's done in the lab is error-prone, so it's not an ideal projective value measure. It's a POVM, it has some noise in it. And secondly, you can only understand classical measurements as the limit of POVM measurements. When I measure a car to have a particular position and momentum, I'm not measuring that to within an h-bar area in phase space, I have some error in both those measurements. But it's still a simultaneous measurement of position and momentum, an error-prone one. And so it's the limit of a POVM that's a simultaneous measurement of those two quantities. So anyways, that's the rough idea. We could look at a lot more examples of POVMs. The other thing I wanted to tell you about was a more generic way of getting a POVM. It's analogous to what we did last time in terms of the two ways of getting a mixed state. One was do a mixture of pure states. The other was prepare an entangled state and ignore half of it. So here, you do a measurement as follows. You take your system, and you prepare another system, which we'll call the ancilla in some state. And then you do a joint measurement on the pair of them. That's something you can certainly do. And it turns out that if you ask, well, how do I model this entire thing as an effective measurement on just the system, the answer is you do it with a POVM. So we're going to launch into another explanation of why that is. So what is the probability of getting outcome k for that final measurement? Well, the state that you feed in is just rho s tensor tau a, the state of the ancilla. And then I have a projector on the bipartite Hilbert space SA, projectors labeled by k. So I just multiply, and I take the trace over the full Hilbert space. That's just applying the Born rule to the pair of systems. And it turns out, and I was thinking of doing this calculation on the board, but maybe we shouldn't in the interest of time. Maybe it's a good problem for a tutorial to work out this development. It involves things like knowing the partial trace and how to manipulate things. You can turn it into this form. You can take this trace SA is really a trace S times a trace A. And you can move the trace A inside and have it just act on the things that depend on A. So this bipartite projector and the density operator for the ancilla system. And so this whole thing now is just an operator on S, because I'm taking an expectation value with respect to a full basis on A. And so it turns out that, you know, the nature of this beast, it's not a scalar, because I still have an S dependence here. It's an operator on S. And so these are my POVM elements for this sort of measurement. So that's what the Born rule looks like for this case. And you can, again, just verify that these operators are positive. So if I sandwich this guy between psi's, it's not completely evident from this form. But if you do the derivation, you'll see other forms where it becomes evident, other forms for this expression, where it's clear that that thing is positive. And they sum to identity, because if I take this expression and I sum over k, well, then I can move the sum inside. These are a resolution of unity. So what I get here is identity on SA, but identity operator on a pair of Hilbert spaces is just a tensor product of the identity operator on each component Hilbert space. So what I have here is trace over A of identity on A tensor identity on S, tau A. If I just do the trace over A, well, identity on A times tau A is just tau A, and the trace of this guy is 1. He's a density operator. So I'm just left with identity on S. So that's why I have the second condition holding. So let's consider an example of that. So this is a bit more interesting than the other ones. So over here, yes? Tau was the density operator for the ancilla, that's right. So I'm imagining, I apologize that this falls off the screen. I'm imagining that I feed in a state which I'm just going to denote theta. So this is the Bloch sphere representation of a qubit. So it's at a theta angle from the north pole in the zx plane.
So that's the ancilla that we're seeing?
That's right. Okay. So the ancilla is going to be a qubit. The system is going to be a qubit, two-dimensional system. I feed in the ancilla in this state.
So in this case, the ancilla is a pure state.
In this case, the ancilla is a pure state, right, which is a special case of compared to here. But it'll make the calculation a little bit easier. And then over on this side, I measure what quantum information theorists call the Bell basis. So these are two qubits, so it's a four-dimensional space. So I need four pure states if I want a basis. And you can see easily that these four states are orthogonal, right? These ones span the 0, 0, and 1, 1 plane, and they're orthogonal to one another. And these guys span an orthogonal plane to them, and they're orthogonal to one another by virtue of this phase difference. And they're all maximally entangled states. So what's the effective measurement here? Well, let's just use the formula we had before. It's trace of the projector onto a particular element times the density operator for the ancilla traced over the ancilla. So in this case, it's very simple, because the projector onto the kth element is just this projector onto a pure state. And the tracing over a pure Ancilla state just corresponds to sandwiching it between the vector associated with that state. That's the data state. OK, so I just need to work out this overlap. So let's do that explicitly. So making theta into a bra, I would have to take the complex conjugate. But these amplitudes are real anyhow. So it's just cos theta over 2, 0 bra plus sine theta over 2, the 1 bra. And let's take psi 1, capital phi 1. So that's just the 0, 0 plus 1, 1 state. OK, so let me label these, be a bit more careful, and label these by S and A. This is S, this is A. OK, so if I, and these are A, these are the Ancilla states. So if I take this overlap, this term and this term overlap, and the overlap of 0, 0 is just 1, so I get a 1 over root 2 cos theta over 2, 0 S from that. This term and this term have zero overlap, because it's 1 on the Ancilla, meaning 0 on the Ancilla. They're orthogonal. This and this give me a 1 over root 2 sine theta over 2 1 s. And this guy and this guy give me 0 again. So it's just this. It's a subnormalized pure state on s. Right, so that's what I've written here. Cos theta over 2, 0, plus sine theta over 2, 1. That's what this overlap is here. You know, if you take something on SA and take the inner product of something on A, you get something just on S. And if I did it for the second state, where there's a minus sign, the only thing that would change is that I get a minus sign there. So this is just the two states on the block sphere corresponding to plus theta and minus theta. Yes?
What is the notation there? V,
yes.
1, 2?
That's my way of writing a plus minus, but where the plus corresponds to 1 and the 2 corresponds to minus. So this is two equations in one, that's all.
Okay.
So then I can look at the same thing, but overlap with the third and the fourth. And it turns out the only difference is that I get the sine theta over 2 here, the cos theta over 2 from the second term. And that corresponds to two other points on the block sphere, the pi minus plus theta points. So at the end of the day, if I now take each of these guys, which are states on S, and I take their outer product with themselves, I get these four effects. A half times the projectron to theta, a half times the projectron to minus theta, and so on. So that should look a little bit familiar. It's just, you know, 4 points at theta minus theta, pi minus theta, pi plus theta. And if I chose theta equal to pi by 4, that would just be the square. We've already seen that's like a rotation of the diamond that we had before. So it's just like that POVM, the first POVM we saw, that was implemented by mixing two measurements. So here, if I mixed the two pure diagonal measurements, I would get the same thing. Now, it turns out what's interesting about these coupling to Ancilla type measurements is that there are POVMs which you can implement in that way, by coupling to an Ancilla, and you can't implement them by any mixture of projective measurements. So you get some, for example, if I look at a triangle in the block sphere, where all three of the effects of rank 1 are on the surface, that's something that you can't get by a mixture of any projective measurements. You have to do it with this coupling to Ancilla scheme. And there's a theorem that shows that any POVM you write down, as long as it has all the right the properties of a POVM, positive, some identity, there is a way, in principle, of implementing it by coupling to an Ancilla. That's called Neumark's theorem. Good. OK, so we've been going for a while. I expected that we might not have time to do how many minutes should I keep going for? I don't
think we have a 10, 15 minutes.
There's about 15 minutes left. So maybe I will talk a little bit about the generalization of transformations. It's not incredibly important for what's going to come later in the course. So if it goes by too quickly and it's not clear. It's not so significant. So maybe I'll just sort of show it to you, let it wash over you. Don't worry too much about it if it's going by too quickly. What I do want to get to at the end is some comments about axiomatization of quantum mechanics. There was one last point I had to make about POVMs, which was just the following. We talked yesterday about how you can choose to measure an apparatus externally or internally. I could assign it a quantum state as well. So what often happens in an apparatus is, you know, you have your particle, and then maybe you have a probe particle, and you interact them together, and the value of some quantity, like the angular momentum of this guy, will, for different values, this particle will be translated by different amounts. And then I'll measure the position of this guy. So in von Neumann's textbook, he writes down these kinds of measurement couplings. In an operational language, what that corresponds to is you take your system in, and you have a probe, which you're going to treat quantum mechanically. You unitarily interact them together, and then you measure some property of the probe. And you infer some properties of the system from that. And now, von Neumann's example corresponded to projective measurements, but there's more general ways of doing this. And what you'll notice is that if you look at this tail end here, unitarily couple, then measure something on the ancilla and ignore the system. Well, ignoring the system is a kind of measurement. This whole thing is just an effective measurement on the pair of systems. And so it looks just like the one we saw in the previous slide. You take an ancilla and you do a measurement on the pair of system and ancilla. So von Neumann's model of measurement is an instance of these more general measurements where you couple to ancillas. Okay, so we now have density operators for preparations, positive operator valued measures for measurements, and previously we said the transformations are associated with unitaries. We want to upgrade that and show that they correspond to trace preserving completely positive linear maps. All right, so it's going to be a very familiar story. The first thing you do is you say, well, what if I had a mixture of unitaries? I rolled some dice with probability distribution PI, and I chose one of several unitaries to implement. Well, the probability of getting outcome K at that final measurement is just going to be its probability given that I rolled I times the probability of I. And now this guy is trace of EK times the unitary evolute of rho, but which unitary evolute depends on how the dice came up. So I have to put a UI in here, and sum over I, of course. And so I move the PI in the brackets, I move the sum into the brackets, and I get this. And so that is a map that takes density operators to other density operators. I'll just call it calligraphic T.
Did I get Q sums over I?
That's a mistake. Sorry, that should not be there. So that's easy to see. What you can also show is that if the rho you put in was a positive operator, I've denoted that as rho greater than 0, but that's just shorthand for the expectation of rho being positive for all psi in the Hilbert space. So if rho is positive, then this guy's positive as well, because all these unitary changes of rho will keep its positivity. And I'm summing them up. So I just have a set of density operators now, summing them up with, this is just a mixture of density operators. It's a density operator. And now there's this complete positivity property. So I have to define that for you. Let me note that, you know, positivity of a map here would be better called positivity preserving. It's a map that preserves the positivity of the things you put into it. So this more general property, you know, complete positivity preservation, basically says that if I act the map on one of a pair of systems in some valid positive quantum state, then I'd better be left with another valid quantum state. So it's not enough that my map acting on quantum states for an individual system keeps me positive. I could also act it on half of an entangled state, for example. And if that left me with a negative bipartite state, I'd be in trouble, because there would be measurements that would get negative probabilities, and it wouldn't make sense. So it turns out you can show that these kinds of maps also satisfy this complete positivity condition. And then finally, it's trace preserving. If I take the trace of this whole expression and I use the cyclic property so that the U dagger comes to the front, I just get identity. I sum over these probabilities, that gives me 1, and I just have trace of rho. Yes?
That's an I, so
A. Where's the, that's right. This map corresponds to doing nothing on the ancillary system. So it's a calligraphic I. That's right. And strictly, there's various ways of defining complete positivity. For example, you'd say, for any dimension of A, this ought to be true. But it actually turns out to be sufficient to prove things that are a bit less general. Yeah, you, if you show it for something that's dimension d squared, then you're OK. So this is just one way of implementing one of these maps. And you know, this is where the name comes from. They have these properties. Completely positive, trace preserving. They're obviously linear because rho appears linearly here. There are other ways of implementing them. So again, this should be very familiar. What you do is you get an ancilla. You couple the system with the ancilla. And then you just ignore the ancilla. And you say, and I let the system move on. What's the overall effect of that coupling? In the von Neumann measurement, we sort of measure the particle. We either measure the system and the ancilla, or we maybe discard the system. Here, we're letting the system through. So this is exactly the sort of diagram I had for von Neumann measurement, except that here I'm doing something trivial. I'm not measuring anything. So I could put a measurement here and then just ignore the outcome. It would have the same effect. If you really look at the von Neumann measurement and you say, suppose there were a measurement here that had a particular outcome, then you would get a set of maps. For every outcome, there would be a different map that acted on the system to update its state. I think I have a slide for that. Let me just breeze through this, and I'll come back. No, I don't. Sorry. let me come back to that question in just a moment. There's a lot of calculations that could be done at great length here, but I'm not sure you'd learn that much from them. This is clearly the expression you should write down for the probability of getting outcome k. It's just rho tensor tau, act with this unitary, ignore the ancilla, so do the trivial measurement, and then do the measurement of interest at the other side. And it turns out that whole thing can be written as just some effective map on rho s times the POVN you're interested in. And it turns out, this tau should be defined in terms of, this is not a tau, this is a capital T. It should be defined in terms of this density operator and this unitary here. And sure enough, you can work out exactly how it depends on it. So it's written in this form, sum over mu, k mu, rho, k mu, where the k mu's now, no dagger here, the k mu's are given in terms of the unitary, and in terms of tau. Tau has this decomposition. This is the tau spectral resolution. So I take these states and the weights, the square roots of the weights. This is an arbitrary basis for the ancilla. I'm not sure these details are very important right now, except to say that, yes, there's a way of calculating exactly what this map is in terms of the components of this box. And the other thing that's significant is this form. So you can show that for the particular k mu's we have here, you can verify the complete positivity condition. You can also verify the trace preserving condition. So if you think of putting the expression for capital T of rho into the trace, right? So let's put this expression into a trace over S, right? So this is all trace over S. I use the cyclic property to take the k mu dagger to the front. Then for that to be equal to the trace of rho, it has to be the case that this sum is identity. And it turns out you can verify that for these sorts of k's, that sum is identity, so everything works out. Question?
So once again, what is mu?
So mu is just a way of, it's my notation for I and j. So rather than writing k sub I, j, I write k mu. I'm sorry I didn't say that explicitly.
So it's really important that there's a sum between the between the two k's on the opposite side of the res of x. So in some sense, you can incoherently have different paths that the system takes in advantage of those.
Yes. Question.
What are the WJs?
The WJs are the weights that appear in the tau. So the tau is the density operator for the ancilla. WJs are the weights in its spectral resolution. So again, I mean, this is really a problem that, you know, would work well in tutorial. You know, you go through all the details, verify all these properties. I'm just sort of flashing it in front of you so that you have some familiarity with what it looks like.
I guess it's probably worth pointing out that every time you transport a quantum mechanical particle in practice, you have this situation.
You mean it's the situation is never ideal. You never have a pure unitary.
It always interacts.
Yeah. That's right. This is also a model of decoherence, right? If a particle interacts with its environment and you don't keep the environment around, you don't measure it, then, you know, you're looking at a particle which has undergone this kind of map. And so this capital T can be close to identity, the identity map, but with, you know, some noise added to it. So I can, you know, for example, on the Bloch sphere, if I had more time, I would show you some simple 2D examples of completely positive maps are ones where every point on the Bloch sphere gets taken to a point that's a little bit inside the Bloch sphere. That's decoherence, because it takes pure states to slightly mix. If you have a lot of decoherence, it makes that Bloch ball smaller and smaller. And in a limit, if you add so much noise to the system, every pure state gets mapped to the completely mixed state, and you lose all information. So for a longer lecture course, all that sort of stuff. The key is that we have these three properties for general transformations. This funny decomposition I showed you is called the Krauss decomposition. Turns out all completely positive maps can be written in this form, where the k mu's are just, the only constraint on them is that they're linear operators, and that they satisfy this identity, which makes sure that it's trace preserving. So that's quite nice. And it ties together a bunch of loose ends, right? So remember our mixture of unitaries? I could always take the PI and write it out as a root PI and a root PI here. And so this root PI UI is just the K mu. So it has the form that I described there. But also, if you look at a von Neumann measurement or a projective measurement, where you don't keep track of the outcome, so you know that this is how you would update your state if you knew that the outcome was K. If you ignore the outcomes, then this is what you get. And that's also of that form here, where the K mu's now are just the pi k's. So the final point is that, you know, the important distinction among these maps are the ones that are reversible, those are just the unitaries, and all the others, the ones that can't be written in this form. And they're all irreversible in the sense that you've lost some information. It's gone to the environment. You can't, unless you get that information back, you can't reverse the operation. Okay, so there was only one component left in the formalism, and I'll rush over this because I don't think it's critical. If you do a measurement and the system gets passed on, then that whole thing is an effective preparation. So these measurements also have a transformation aspect to them. They take density operators and they generate new density operators. And it turns out that the way you represent that action is almost exactly the same as for the general transformations, except it's trace decreasing completely positive linear maps. So now the trace might become less than the trace of the original state. So if this was 1, this thing could be less. And that corresponds to the fact that if I condition on getting an outcome of the measurement, it doesn't occur with probability 1. So this actually gives me the probability of getting a certain outcome in the measurement, the outcome associated with that map. So again, it is not critical for the rest of the course. I just wanted to sort of show you all this stuff so that you had some vague familiarity with it and some vague impression of why we need these more general maps. This is, you know, the case where you actually keep track of the outcome k. It has that form. It doesn't preserve the trace. Oh, here's another example. We talked about this yesterday. If I have the field operator, if I detect an excitation at position r, then we update a pure state by acting with the field operator on it. A mixed state, you would just put the field operator's dagger around it. So again, that's of that form, where the probability, the overall trace of this is less than 1. So this is how I update when I do photo detection. So it all fits in nicely. All these sort of loose ends, the puzzles that I talked about earlier, they all end up being examples of this formalism. Yes?
Sorry, I know you said it's not important for the rest of the course, but I'm just trying to figure out, if we said that a density operator passed out trace one, then how are we to interpret the object that is the result of a trace decreasing completely up?
Yeah. So you could write down a subnormalized density operator and say this is the density operator times the probability that it's going to be the output of this device. If you want, you can normalize it. You could just take that map acting on your density operator, divide by the trace of that map acting on your density operator, and now you have a normalized density operator. So if I had more time, I would sort of go slowly through all those details. I mean, it's a very beautiful formalism. So I urge you, if you're interested, to Nielsen and Truong, for example, has a very nice exposition of completely positive maps. And I think it's great stuff. But because it won't be very significant for what we're doing, I thought it's better to talk about other things that we're going to need more. So let me just leave you on one note. We've simplified our axioms now, so we have this much more general mathematical framework, and the axioms make reference to preparations and measurements and how we ought to model them. And so a natural question to ask is, are those axioms logically independent? Are those postulates really independently changeable? Because that's what you'd ideally like in postulates, a set of logically independent assumptions. And it turns out they're not. So you can infer things about the structure of measurements from the structure of preparations. From the way you model preparations, that has some consequences for the way you have to model measurements. So this is what I want to end on. There's something called Gleason's theorem, very important result in the foundations of quantum mechanics. The original theorem of Gleason applied to Hilbert spaces of dimension 3. And very recently, the spirit of his theorem has been generalized to all dimensions by making use of things like POVMs. I'm going to tell you about sort of an unconventional version of Gleason's theorem, but it has the same spirit. The point is this. It says, what sorts of functions over density operators can one have that satisfy certain properties? The function is meant to be something that tells you the probability of an outcome of a measurement following a preparation associated with rho. So think of it this way. You're saying, we found a bunch of measurements in quantum mechanics. They're represented in a certain way. And now we want to know, is there some other measurement out there that behaves differently? It gives me different probabilities. Maybe we haven't observed it yet, or maybe it's not part of the regular quantum formalism, but perhaps there are these other measurements where the probabilities come out differently. So let's explore an arbitrary function of rho. So F is going to represent the probability of the first outcome of some putative measurement. What do we need to assume about it? Well, it has to be between 0 and 1, because we're assuming it's a probability. So that's fine. And then the second assumption is this, that if I take a mixture of density operators, I get the same mixture of the probabilities of that outcome, given rho and given rho prime, where, of course, the weight is a probability. So what we have to ask is, what's the significance of that assumption? In a sense, it looks trivial, right? If I just do a mixture of two preparations, right, with weights W and 1 minus W, and I say, what's the overall probability of getting an outcome K for a subsequent measurement given that mixture? Well, it's very simple. I say, the probability of getting outcome K, given that I did this mixture-type preparation, is just the probability of getting outcome K, given that I did P, times the probability I did P, plus the probability of getting outcome K given P prime, given that I implemented P prime. That's just, again, phase rule. And so if F represents the probability of an outcome of some measurement, then it had better satisfy that equation. So it looks like it's almost a trivial extra constraint. You would obviously want your function to satisfy this. But it's not so trivial. And here's the reason it's not. It's the ambiguity of mixtures again. So I can prepare identity over 2 this way, I can prepare it that way. And this functional constraint tells me that f of identity over 2 should be this sum for this case, and should be this other sum for this case. So that second assumption in Gleason's theorem actually has some content. It says these putative measurements you're imagining they give you the same probability for a mixture of 0 and 1 as they do for a mixture of plus and minus. So the assumption in Gleason's theorem is that this putative measurement is like quantum measurements insofar as it can't distinguish this and this. But besides that, let's let it be arbitrary. And then the amazing thing is that you can show that if you make those assumptions, you can prove that that function has to be the form trace E rho, where E is one of these positive operators less than identity. And so quantum mechanics is a very tight package. You can't change the mathematical structure of the measurements independently of the mathematical structure of the preparations. With this very weak assumption about the indistinguishability of mixtures that are deemed indistinguishable in quantum mechanics, you already get the formalism. And so this, I wanted to put this up here because this has the flavor of, it's on the road towards a proper axiomatization of quantum theory. You want to reduce the number of postulates. Next time, Lucien Hardy is going to talk to you about a very famous result of his on axiomatizing quantum mechanics where he succeeds in reducing the postulates still further. So that'll be tomorrow. That's it.